Thank you very much to everyone for joining today. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Chad Pecron. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Little Rock Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. And just a couple housekeeping matters. First of all, we're doing this in the webinar format today. So if you have any questions for our speaker, please type them into the Q&A at the bottom of the page. And I will ask them during the question and answer part of this at the end. Our speaker today would like to have a lot of questions, so hopefully we can have a good discussion going. Second of all, I'd like to thank State Senator Ballinger, who's on the call with us today. Thank you, Senator, for joining us today, as well as everyone else. And with that, today I'll introduce our speaker. Paul Avalar is the managing attorney of the Institute for Justice Arizona office. Paul litigates all sorts of constitutional cases in state and federal courts around the country, including free speech, property rights, economic liberty, and school choice. Perhaps most relevant to Arkansas, Paul drafted the Natural Hair Braiding Protection Act, which was adopted a few years ago with the help of Senator Ballinger and others in the legislature. Before joining the Institute for Justice, Paul worked as an attorney in Philadelphia. Before that, he clerked for Judge Roger Miner on the Second Circuit, Justice Andrew Hurwitz on the Arizona Supreme Court, and Judge Daniel Barker on the Arizona Court of Appeals. Paul graduated from the Arizona State University College of Law and is a graduate of Princeton University. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my good friend, Paul Avalar.
Thank you, Chad, and thanks for having me, everyone. I'm seeing a couple of familiar names and old friends on the attendee list. I'm glad you guys are here and haven't gotten tired of hearing me tell this story. So let's start with a story. And Chad alluded to this earlier, but this is the story of Christine McLean. She was born in Ivory Coast, and as was common in her culture, she learned how to braid when she was still a little girl. She immigrated to the U.S. in 1998, along with her son. And since coming to the U.S., she worked to support herself through braiding in various shops and salons across the country. With someone who had skills in braiding, she was in great demand, and she managed to make a good living for herself. So what is natural hair braiding? For those of you who aren't intimately familiar with Arkansas's still relatively new laws on this, thank you, Senator Ballinger. Natural hair braiding is just braiding hair. Doesn't use chemicals. You're not cutting hair. You're not using heat or these chemicals to change or damage the structure of hair. It is literally just braiding hair. In 2011, Christine had the chance to buy her own shop in Little Rock, and she sank her life savings into it. That business, which is still there today, it's called LaBelle African Hair Braiding, allowed Christine to become an entrepreneur. She was able to hire people to work in her shop, and she was successful enough in her business that she was able to put her son through college by braiding hair. But there was a problem. Arkansas, like many states at the time, required a license to braid hair, in this case, a cosmetology license. Christine was not a licensed cosmetologist. So the first time an inspector came to her shop, he complimented her on the cleanliness of her shop, on how well run it is, and then he gave her a fine for braiding hair without a license. Christine looked into cosmetology school. It required 1,500 hours of classes, nearly a year's worth of schooling. It would prevent her from working while she was in school. So not only would she not be able to earn money while she was in school, she also had to pay anywhere between $8,000 and $20,000 to go to school. And Christine wouldn't have learned anything about natural hair braiding in school. It's just not taught as part of the curriculum. Plus, as it turns out, all the written materials and tests are not really appropriate for someone who has English as a second language, or in Christine's case, I think a fourth language. So what could she do? She couldn't work. Her son was depending on her, but working wasn't legal. So she kept working. And over the next 3 years, Christine and her business were fined several times to the tune of a couple of thousands of dollars solely for braiding hair without a license or allowing other people to braid without a license. What could she do? Let's put a pin on that. Occupational licensing is, put simply, government permission to work in a particular field. In the 1950s, about 1 in 20 American workers needed a license to do their job. Today, that figure stands at about 1 in 4, best estimates. So we're looking at overall a growth from 5% to 20-25%, a 4 or 5 times growth in occupational licensing. And often when we think about occupational licensing, we think of doctors or lawyers. But as Christine's story shows, it includes other jobs, jobs like hair braiding, or florists, or nursery workers, or taxidermists, plumbers, bartenders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of these jobs are at or below median pay in this country. Indeed, occupational licensing is probably the single biggest issue in labor economics today. It affects far more people than unionism does, which is about 11%, give or take, and the minimum wage, which is, I think, less than 5%, though, with states changing that those numbers seem to be changing a little bit. Regardless, this is a nonpartisan issue. Both the Obama administration and Trump administrations agreed on the need for various reforms in these areas. And my guess is that the Biden administration will also agree, given then Vice President Biden's participation in then President Obama's efforts. And I saw on the call that Dan Greenberg is on the call. For those of you who don't know, Dan did yeoman's work during the Trump administration, going to state, trying to convince them to get rid of occupational licensing burdens, and was successful in a number of states, and a number of states, frankly, just continue to avoid trying to make any changes in this area. And I will come back to why that is in a moment. Why is it that the Obama and Trump administrations would agree on the need for occupational licensing reform? I mean, these are two administrations that couldn't agree if fire was hot or water was wet. And yet on occupational licensing, they did seem to be very much aligned. Well, part of that is economics. Occupational licensing has been shown to increase unemployment by, you know, 0.5%, 1%, which is a lot of jobs in the aggregate. And it also increases consumer prices by 15% or more, given the numbers that we have. The studies also show that there are relatively few benefits to the consumer. And this is not me, crazy libertarian, saying this. That was the position that the Obama administration came to in 2015, and then the Trump administration agreed with. There's little to no evidence that licensing benefits consumers, especially given other sorts of consumer protection laws that are out there, or other things that serve to protect consumers, like reputation or general legal remedies and generally competition. Moreover, licensing is particularly burdensome on certain populations, the poor especially. It costs money to get all of the training required, to take all the tests, to take time away from work in order to get those that education or that experience or take those exams. And in looking at things like student loan default rates across the country, as an example, which schools or degrees have the highest rates? Well, they're actually almost entirely cosmetology schools. Last I saw, something like 25 of the top 30 schools by loan default rate in this country were cosmetology schools. On top of that, it's particularly burdensome for groups like immigrants. They tend not to have the same education as native-born Americans. And this isn't just trade school or college or even high school. I've represented women who had no more than a fourth grade education because where they came from, girls just weren't sent to school. So when a license requires advanced training or even just a high school diploma, what are they to do? I have a friend in Tennessee who has been just finished representing a man there for several years who wanted to be a barber, but was not allowed to even go to barber school because he didn't have a high school diploma. And he didn't have a high school diploma because he dropped out of high school to take care of his younger siblings when both of his parents were killed. Occupational licensing prevented him from pursuing his career as a barber because he didn't have a high school diploma, even though high school diploma really not necessary for someone who's going to go cut hair since they're going to barber school already. Relatedly, there are issues with English. Again, Christine's story. Christine is perfectly conversant in English, but the written materials maybe not generated for, maybe not suitable for someone who has English as a second language. I've been working with a group of women actually here in Arizona because Arizona has a law requiring a certain amount of English proficiency for people who want to become massage therapists, for example. Well, you may say, well, that doesn't sound too unreasonable, except for there's only three occupations in Arizona that have any sort of English proficiency requirement. Why massage therapists? And then to just further the problems with this system, the board chose to set a standard for English proficiency that was in excess of the standard the public schools out or the public universities out here have for admission to their graduate programs. It's easier to get a PhD with limited English in Arizona than it is to become a licensed massage therapist. Other people who this particularly hurts, and people may be interested in, late career switchers. And this also includes, say, mothers who are re-entering the workforce. These are two groups of people who, because you have to be up to date on training and classes in order to come into this area, it's hard to do that without, you know, dropping everything else you're doing, your family, schooling, whatever, or your work, to go to school and get that sort of training. And then on an issue that I know Dan was particularly focused on when he was working with the Trump administration is people who move across state lines. Licensing is done state by state by state. And just because you can work in one state doesn't mean that you can necessarily work in another state. And this issue really came to the front, you know, about a year ago. We had this thing, I don't know if you remember it, called COVID. You know, it was 2 weeks and then everything passed. But one of the things that came out of COVID was the realization that it was very difficult for a lot of medical professionals to go from state to state to state, because although they were perfectly licensed and qualified in, say, Arizona, they were not then allowed to go to, say, California or Texas or Arkansas or vice versa and practice where they were needed. A lot of the emergency orders that we saw coming out of COVID really had to do with telling these licensing boards, hey, anyone wants to come here, don't let licensing get in the way. You get them here. We need them. Some states have started to address this issue more broadly. Arizona and Utah, excuse me, in particular, have gone to a universal recognition system where they will recognize and allow anyone with a license from any other state to come in and just get a license. No more, no muss, no fuss. Let's streamline this as much as possible. Other states have tried and failed to do that, but that's another issue where we've seen a lot of growth. And licensing is oftentimes irrational. I mean, Christine needed 1,500 hours of training to get a cosmetologist license in Arkansas. She would have needed less than 150 to get an EMT license. And which one of those licenses do you think has to do more with public health or safety? Cosmetologists or EMTs? Still, cosmetologists, 10 times the requisite training. So given all these problems, why have these at all? Why have occupational licensing at all? Well, it's sold on public safety, but it's really insider interest. I talked earlier about the growth in occupational licensing. One third of the growth of that licensing growth is due to a changing composition of the workforce. As a percentage, more Americans today are doctors and lawyers and dentists and things like that than they used to be. Okay. But two thirds of that growth, that four or five fold growth, comes from an increase in the number of licensed professions. That is, we are licensing occupations that we never, ever did before. Why are we doing that? Well, again, studies show, the infamous studies show, that licensed professions' degree of political influence is one of the most important factors in determining whether states regulate an occupation. You may think that sounds backwards, and it does to a lot of people initially. You have to remember that occupational licensing is essentially a fence around an industry. It restricts competition with the people who are already in the industry. And so licensing tends to be most popular with people who are already working in the field and would really like to restrict competition. This is the idea of regulatory capture. And for those of you who have spent time in and around the legislature, you've probably seen this phenomenon up close and personal, where you get a group come to the legislature and they say, listen, what we do is really dangerous. We could literally kill people. You need to license this industry to protect public health. And when you do, you grandfather all of us, but you make all the new people take all of this onerous training and have all of these onerous certifications. And that'll really help the public. Another way that this manifests is with board membership itself. Most occupations in this country are regulated through these boards. And board membership most often is dominated by or controlled by industry insiders. So for example, the medical examiner's board consists almost entirely or maybe entirely of doctors. Or in a very famous example coming out of North Carolina, the North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners consisted entirely of dentists, elected, chosen for the board by other dentists. I take that back. There was one non-dentist on the board. The non-dentist on the board was a dental hygienist who worked for dentists. And responding to complaints from dentists, the board decided that basically over-the-counter teeth whitening, the equivalent of Crest white strips, was the practice of dentistry. What was happening was salons and day spas were giving people these, you know, teeth whitening, over-the-counter teeth whitening kits for use there. And a lot of dentists started complaining about this competition. And so the board, without any evidence of harm to the public, started sending out cease and desist letters to these non-dentists for the unlicensed practice of dentistry. The Federal Trade Commission cracked down on that. And so a couple of years ago, there's a very important decision called North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners called Federal Trade Commission, in which the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, you know, this board, it's controlled by market participants, and they don't have sovereignty. They are subject to antitrust laws. And so in that case, they actually found an antitrust violation against the Board of Dental Examiners. But, you know, that's another example of why some of this occupational licensing has become a problem. Now, ordinarily here, this is when I'm talking to law students about this issue, you know, because law students like to talk about cases. I talk about the history of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court primarily about the famous or infamous cases that have really led to this problem, the slaughterhouse cases. Bradwell v. Illinois, the case that said Myra Bradwell was not allowed Myra Bradwell could be excluded from being a licensed attorney, not because she was unqualified. The court recognized she had all of the qualifications to practice law, solely because she was a woman. And that today, that case is taught as an equal protection case. It wasn't. It was actually a case that said that as a citizen of the United States, she had a privilege or immunity to practice an occupation, and that she couldn't be denied that occupation without a really good reason. And she argued she didn't have one. There's, of course, the Lochner case, Lochner v. New York, which in law school we're all taught is essentially the boogeyman. Lochner is actually a really interesting case in terms of what was happening behind the scenes and what the U.S. Supreme Court's decision was. There's the Caroline Products case, which is the birth of the rational basis test, which federal courts apply to restrictions on people's ability to work, and how that mutated in a case called Williamson v. Lee Optical, where the court really sort of signaled in some ways the death of economic liberty at the federal courts. It's not to say it's completely dead. Obviously, IJ have won several economic liberty cases, have challenged several occupational licensing laws under the federal rational basis test, and have won. We challenged it in Arkansas, and I like to believe that we would have won there, except for the story got out, and lawmakers who understood what the problems were stepped up to eliminate the license. And that was then Representative Bob Ballinger carried that bill, which was passed, but not without a lot of opposition. We may think, oh, it's braiding, of course that's safe, but we had to overcome opposition from cosmetologists. We had to overcome opposition from the State Department of Health. And we also had to overcome opposition from a lot of other occupations who were worried that this was the camel's nose under the tent, and that, if God help us, if the legislature starts looking at licensing and realizes how stupid this one is, they might realize how stupid some of the other ones are, and then we would lose our license. So that's the very much the dynamic at play in the legislatures today. Whenever the legislatures, in my experience, talks about getting rid of a license, or talks about adding a license, the people who show up are the people in the industry. The public generally doesn't. The public generally doesn't have the time or the energy or really the investment to go fight these things. But the industry is always there because it's really their money on the line. So let's talk about solutions. There's of course antitrust, which I mentioned already. There are federal lawsuits, which I'm happy to talk about more. And there's legislation and policy. And that has a lot of going for it. There have been a number of reforms across the country, I think reflecting this bipartisan recognition that there's a problem here. But my job here at IJ is to sue the government. I love suing the government. That's what I exist to do. So we continue to litigate in this area, not just on behalf of braiders, but on groups like technology startups or Uber drivers or veterinarians, just all sorts of industries where we're seeing these problems. I can go on and on and on about this issue, but I know there are people on this call who are very knowledgeable about the issue. And really, I love questions and conversation. So if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to take them or start a conversation on what can be done in Arkansas specifically. Arkansas still has problems despite lots of people's best efforts. We still rank Arkansas, and we do a report every couple of years called License to Work, which is sort of a 50 state survey of occupational licensing. We still rank Arkansas as the sixth most burdensome and the third most broadly and onerously licensed state. Arkansas still licenses a number of occupations that other states just don't. Nursery workers, for example, are licensed in just one other state beyond Arkansas. Psychiatric technicians are licensed in Arkansas, but most states don't do that. Title examiners are licensed in lots of places, but Arkansas has particularly onerous burdens on them. Fire alarm installer is another one. Arkansas requires 5 years worth of experience and about $1,500 or so and exams and fees and all the rest of that before you can become a fire alarm installer, an occupation that lots of other states don't license at all. So there is, of course, work to be done in Arkansas as well as everyone else, as well as everywhere else. And I'm happy to answer any questions you guys have. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul. And I'm going to take the moderator's privilege to ask the first question here. And I'm actually going to preface it by making a pitch for the next event here in Little Rock, which is being put on by our student chapter at the Bowen Law School on litigating claims under the Arkansas State Constitution. Justice Sean Womack from the Arkansas Supreme Court will be speaking on that. And you all should have gotten information about that, and I'll be resending it again. But Paul, the question I was going to ask from that is, does IJ, when IJ is looking at bringing claims, how does it decide whether to bring claims under the federal constitution or under the state constitution or both? And what do you look for in state constitutions in terms of these type of challenges?
So the answer is, as with all things in the law, it's complicated and it depends. Part of that is there are a number of states out there that are or should be more protective of economic liberty than is the federal, than is current federal jurisprudence. I mentioned this earlier, the rational basis test. That's the test that applies in federal courts under the federal constitution for restrictions on your right to earn an honest living. And the problem with the rational basis, well, there's many problems with the rational basis test. The biggest one is that it requires neither a rationale nor a basis. Under that test, courts basically presume constitutionality. They presume the existence of facts that supports the restriction. They don't care why they don't have to care why a regulation was actually implemented. The tailoring between the supposed concern and the regulation, that is the fit between the two, is loose to non-existent. Let me give you an example. I lost a case where the state conceded, this is another hair-braiding case, the state conceded that 1,400 of its 1,500-hour curriculum were irrelevant to braiders. It conceded that. The court said it didn't matter, that 100 hours was enough to bootstrap the entire regulatory scheme. So 100 hours was arguably relevant, therefore the state could make them do absolutely everything. That's the sort of loose fit that we see. Now, a lot of states have rejected that approach. Pennsylvania, for example, has repeatedly and recently said that its constitution is more protective of economic liberty than is the federal constitution. Texas, in a 2015 case called Patel, specifically said, look, our jurisprudence is a little all over the place, but our constitution is more protective, and so it requires a higher showing by the government, and we're not going to do what the federal courts do, which is if the government can't meet its burden, it's the judge's job to come up with reasons to justify the regulation. Texas judges don't do that. There have to be actual reasons, and the state actually has to give a reason why it has a regulation in place in the first place. Other states ought to have similar rules. I'm in Arizona. I've spent a lot of time looking at this. Arizona used to have precisely that rule in our own jurisprudence. And then over time, lawyers forgot about our state constitution and really only started talking about federal case law. And the Arizona case law gets really confused. And sometimes they talk about the old standards and sometimes they talk about rational basis. And it you read the cases, it just doesn't make any sense. So those are the sorts of things we look at when we're considering federal versus state, which is the state more protective? Should it be? Is there some reason to believe it should be? What have the federal courts said about a particular issue? Is there some reason to believe that we could succeed in federal court on a federal claim? Would that have more applicability to other people rather than just a victory in, Arizona or Pennsylvania or what have you? So it all depends. One of the things that's going to be talked about at the event you mentioned, because one of my colleagues Justin Pearson from IJ is going to be speaking at that is, a lot of states have things like anti-monopoly provisions that have no parallel in the federal constitution. Is there some way that you can use that? We litigated, and Justin litigated specifically, about Arkansas's anti-monopoly provision. And did that allow the city of Little Rock to restrict taxi cabs, who could own a cab and who couldn't? So there's those sorts of things to look at. But, you know, as a general rule, it comes down to that old saw, it's complicated and it depends.
Thanks. The next question we have is asking you to discuss why you don't oppose occupational licensing under the Ninth Amendment.
Well, the short answer is that the federal courts don't think the Ninth Amendment is really a thing. And I think they're wrong about that, but I'm not going to beat my head against that brick wall when we have other venues or avenues to pursue. So currently under federal law, the right to earn a living or right to economic liberty is protected by a couple of different provisions. Most obviously, there is the due process and equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment. There should be the privileges or immunities clause of the 14th Amendment as well. That was basically read out of existence in the slaughterhouse cases. There's the privileges and immunities clause in the Fifth Amendment, and there's this idea of the dormant commerce clause. So two terms back, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case called Tennessee Wine and Liquor. I just call it the Tennessee Wine and Liquor case. Tennessee Wine and Liquor Retailers Association versus some government functionary. This was a case about a law that Tennessee had restricting who could be a liquor retailer in the state. And they had a very restrictive rule that not only required you to be a resident of the state, and they defined residency in such a way that it basically excluded any national corporation. You also had to essentially be a resident for 10 years before you could apply. And the court struck this down as unconstitutional as a privileges and immunities / dormant commerce clause problem, because it discriminated against people from out of state coming into the state to earn a living. And that's a protected right under the privileges and immunities clause. In the legal context, since I think most people on this call are probably lawyers at some point, there's a case called Piper versus New Hampshire Supreme Court, mid-80s case, I think 85, where Piper wanted to be a licensed New Hampshire attorney. The problem was she lived 400 feet outside of New Hampshire in Vermont, and the New Hampshire Supreme Court had a rule that said you could only be a licensed attorney in New Hampshire if you lived physically in New Hampshire. And the U.S. Supreme Court struck this one down as well as a privileges and immunities clause problem. So there are those sorts of protections that exist. So long as the Ninth Amendment means nothing to the courts, we can keep saying it, but if we're going to win, we're going to have to win under these other legal theories, these other claims.
Next question I wanted to follow up with is from our friend, Mr. Greenberg, and he asks you, suppose Arkansas has two requirements to get a cosmetology license. One requirement seems to pass a rational basis test. The other requirement seems to fail it. And the example he gives is, for instance, cosmetologists must receive 80 hours of training in hygiene and sanitation, but also must receive 50 hours of training in courtesy, neatness, and professional attitude in meeting the public. In Arkansas, do you know if the failure of one requirement is sufficient to get the court to strike down the entirety?
So the courts have not been super clear on this. Let's start with the states. There are a number of states that say, look, there are some occupations that are just so safe and so common that the government has no business licensing it at all. Iowa's got something of a rule like this. Utah has something of a rule like this. I think there's that rule in Arizona, though the courts are a little mealy-mouthed about this sort of thing. The federal courts have not quite taken that track. What the federal courts have done is said, look, we look at this license in the aggregate, in the whole. And we ask ourselves essentially, how applicable is it? What are the dangers that this is meaning to address? How well does this address this as applied? How are the burdens? And so far, what the courts have said is, you know, this licensing scheme is unjustifiably burdensome when it comes to this particular issue, like Brady. The cosmetology licensing scheme is unconstitutional as applied to braiding because it just doesn't fit. It's overly burdensome. There aren't the real health and safety issues that we're talking about. But they've not foreclosed applying a different licensing scheme to braiding. They should, but they haven't. The question is, how would you challenge the part of the scheme, but not the other? And you can do that. I'm not aware of any cases that come right out and do that. And of course, the other problem is, given the loose fit that rational basis is, whether this is right or wrong, this is what would happen. The courts would say, well, yeah, those 50 hours are irrelevant, but looking at the larger scheme as a whole, the 50 hours really aren't all that burdensome. And so the scheme as a whole is okay. Now, that's not to say there aren't ways that you could challenge particular parts of a curriculum, but that's not really where the litigation has gone, so far as I'm aware.
Senator Ballinger asked and said quite candidly, we still stink on this issue. What's our next step in the legislature to fix it?
Well, there's a couple of different steps. There are substantive steps and what we call procedural steps. So the substantive steps are stop making new licenses, get rid of licenses you don't need, and start reducing licenses that you can't eliminate. Like, you know, there's an argument to be made, for example, Milton Friedman made this argument. An argument to be made that we don't even need to license doctors or lawyers. I'm quite sure I will go to my grave and doctors and lawyers will still be licensed. But there's a lot of work that can be done around exclusive scopes of practice, for example. You know, in some states, nurse practitioners are allowed to practice independently. In other states, nurse practitioners have to practice under the supervision or can only practice under the supervision of a doctor. Are there health outcome differences between those two states? Yes, as it turns out, independent nurse practitioners are better for health outcomes than nurse practitioners under a doctor's supervision, because it means nurse practitioners can be more out there. Prices are driven down. People are more able to access that sort of thing. So you can look at scopes of practice, expanding lower level scopes of practice, allowing overlapping scopes of practice. So it's, you know, you don't get into these turf wars between this industry and that industry. And as an aside, one of the funniest legislative hearings I've ever seen in my entire life was here in Arizona, where the issue was animal chiropractic and who got to do chiropractic on animals, horses in particular, but all animals. And, you know, the veterinarians were screaming bloody murder that the chiropractors would injure animals, and the chiropractors were screaming bloody murder that the vets would injure animals because they didn't know chiropractic. You know, the answer is they can both probably do it. Why are we setting up this turf war between them? So that's something the legislature can do. Now, I fully appreciate that those things are hard to do, not because the policy is complicated. Again, this is an issue on which I think the policy arguments have been won, and it's not even a partisan issue anymore. Both, as I said, Democrats and Republicans have come to see this as a problem. The problem is really one of political will. You know, Senator Ballinger, you're perfectly aware that when you're talking about licensing, it's the industry that shows up, and the general public generally does not, either because they don't know or because it's just not a big issue for them. Structurally, there are also things that can be done. There are things like sunrise and sunset. Sunrise is a process, a review process that a licensing proposal has to go through before the legislature can even take up whether to to create a license. It has to go through what's supposed to be a fairly rigorous process to really document, is there a problem? What are other states doing? Is licensing actually a solution to this problem? Are there alternatives to licensing that are less burdensome and more essentially better for protecting the public? Sunset is that same process, but after the license exists already. That is, at regular intervals, so in some states you have you're supposed to have a study. Is this license doing what it's doing or doing what it's supposed to do? Has the situation changed? Is there still a public health and safety need for this? What have other states done? Is there a change here? Sunrise has proven to be better at preventing bad legislation than Sunset has proven to repeal bad legislation. Again, I hate to keep like referring back to the Obama administration's report, especially when I know that others have done a lot of good work on this, but it is sort of a one-stop shop for a lot of this stuff. Sunset has proven to be largely a failure, in part because the rigorousness of the studies just aren't, the rigorousness of the Sunset process just isn't there. And even when the Sunset process does recommend eliminating a license, you still have to overcome the political will problem. And so you have a license that is recommended to be sunsetted and the legislature will keep it in place anyway. Or I think there's one instance where the legislature actually sunsetted a program and then brought the license back based on industry outcry. There's an interesting issue in Texas right now, where last year the Texas legislature allowed the plumber's license to sunset. They wanted to eliminate it. They wanted to get rid of it. And the governor, invoking emergency powers, not under for COVID, invoking emergency powers related to a hurricane that was 2 years before, said, oh, no, we need licensed plumbers in Texas. And so basically overrode the sunsetting of the plumber's license. The irony being that now when Texas had its recent problems with winter weather, they're short on plumbers. And plumbers can't really just come in from other states because they don't have a Texas plumber's license. But there are those sorts of structural reforms that can be done. I would particularly encourage looking at Colorado and Vermont, of all places, have really robust sunrise and sunset programs because they've entrusted those programs not to the industry itself or not to the agency itself. There's a standalone agency that reviews these things and comes up with policy recommendations. Other sort of smaller things that can be done if you can't eliminate the board or eliminate the license, eliminate the board's power, make the board's advisory to someone else who actually does the regulation. Utah is an example of this. There is a director of occupational and professional licensing, an individual who is empowered to actually do the licensing. He's like the head of the agency. There are boards in Utah. There's a cosmetology board. There's a nurse board. There's a board for hunting guides and other things like that. But they only advise. And ultimately, it's up to the head of the agency to make the decision on what rules to have or how to do enforcement, things like that. The nice part about that system is it breaks the industry control to a certain degree, and is a check on that sort of regulatory capture problem. It's not a perfect system, but it's a pretty good one. Other states have gone, like California, for example, has required that a majority of board members be public members rather than industry members. And this is a way of ensuring of trying to ensure that these boards don't become captured by the industry itself. California's had this rule in place since the 1970s, so I guess it's no boon to small regulation, but it's something. And the nice part about that is that those tend to go along with the antitrust issues that I mentioned earlier. So there's a whole lot that can be done here substantively and procedurally. And the answer is all of the above. We didn't get into this problem overnight. It took several decades of of growth in terms of occupational regulation. It took several decades of the court sort of washing their hands and not being a check on this anymore. So there's lots of this is a target-rich environment. There are lots of things that can be done. They're all, you know, steps along the way of making the system better.
The next question was texted to me, and it asked for you to talk just briefly about the history of licensing, and in particular, what the history of licensing was in England before the creation of the Constitution and in the United States before the 14th Amendment.
Sure. So occupational licensing itself in the U.S. has a very bad history. Occupational licensing in the U.S. really sort of finds its roots in the Black codes in the South following the Civil War, where a lot of these codes were enacted to restrict the economic liberty of the freedmen. They were not allowed to work in certain occupations. They were only allowed to work in certain places, things like that. There were sort of antecedents that some people say are antecedents to occupational licensing in England. This is the guild system or the monopoly system, where the king would grant a monopoly right to a certain guild. And so only members of that guild could do a certain thing. The history on that is a little convoluted. And frankly, not really a part of the American tradition. You don't really see occupational licensing in the U.S., as I said, until 1870s or 1880s, and that's where you get things like licensed physicians. The first occupational licensing case that the U.S. Supreme Court ever took was in 1889, Dent v. I think it's West Virginia, and it has to do with the licensing of medical professionals. And what the Supreme Court said in that is the states have the police power to regulate for public health and safety. And this is a regulation of who can provide medical services. And that certainly implicates the question of public health and safety. And that's all we've been asked. And so that's all we're going to decide. Over time, you see a couple more iterations of this. Lochner v. New York, which I talked about earlier, was a case over the New York Bake Shop Act. And that was a case that regulated, it wasn't a license, but it regulated the baking industry. And we mostly know that case today for Oliver Wendell Holmes's dissent in that case. What we overlook a lot is what was actually at issue. The Bake Shop Act implemented a bunch of regulations, things like basic sanitation requirements, things like facilities requirements. You couldn't run a bake shop in a basement because of inadequate ventilation and fire hazards. Okay, fine. And the Supreme Court basically blessed all of those sorts of regulations as having a reasonable relationship to an issue of public health and safety. Lochner, as we know, it was really about the maximum hours law. And what the Lochner court decided, 5-3-1, one being Holmes, five being the majority, was that there was essentially a right to contract that was subject to the police power, but the police power was limited to public health and safety issues, and that there was not a sufficient public health or safety issue in the case to justify restricting people's right to contract. The primary dissent in that case basically goes along with the majority at all but the last step. They say, look, we agree. There's a right to contract. We agree it can be subject to police powers restrictions on public health and safety. But we part ways because we think there is a sufficient public health and safety issue here. Professor David Bernstein wrote a really good book on this a couple of years ago called Rehabilitating Lochner. If you have a really interest in the Lochner case itself and how it was seen at the time and how it began to be seen later. I think that's a really interesting book. Subsequently, you had the birth of the rational basis test and Caroline products. And then this Williamson v. Lee Optical case that I talked about. Williamson v. Lee Optical is a really horrible decision from the US Supreme Court. In that case, it seems weird to think about it now, but at one point, Lee Optical, that model was was actually quite new. And what Lee Optical did was they took old lenses that people had and they fit them to new frames. Back when we as Americans were much poorer, people would take old lenses and put them into new frames because it was less expensive. And optometrists, I always get these terms, and the people who originally give you a prescription for the lenses and originally sell you the glasses opposed this sort of thing because, frankly, they saw it as cutting into their model or into their business. And so they, in a number of states, Oklahoma being one of them, got laws passed that said only they could fit old lenses into new frames. And that was challenged. Why would Oklahoma have implemented that rule? Well, Lee Optical was an outside company out of state, and the opticians the optometrists were all Oklahoma residents. So they had a real interest in protecting the Oklahoma residents from this, you know, outside competition, and that's the rule they passed. The district court in that case struck the regulation down as having an insufficient connection to public health and safety under the rational basis test. That is, they looked at the facts of the case and said, look, there's not really a legitimate public health and safety issue here. There's no reason to restrict who can put old lenses in new frames. If we're talking about who can prescribe lenses in the first place, that would be a different thing. But this is just old lenses and new frames. Williamson v. Lee Optical basically came in and said, look, all this fact stuff, we don't really care. So long as we can come up with, hypothecate something that the legislature could have been thinking, it doesn't matter if that's true or not, that's what we're going to do. And so rather than look at any of the factual record, they just said, we don't care. The legislature may have thought this was a good health and safety issue, and that's as far as we need to go. Lee Optical's, like I said, a horrible decision. What's interesting is that 2 years later, they really required a factual showing in a case called Schwer versus New Mexico Bar Examiners. In that case, lots of people think about Schwer as a free speech First Amendment case. Now it's a 14th Amendment case, where Schwer was qualified to, or the question was Schwer qualified to be a lawyer? And New Mexico said, well, no, we have concerns about his history. He has a criminal history. He was a communist, et cetera, et cetera. U.S. Supreme Court said, well, look, those aren't really about his qualifications, and did a close factual analysis of Schwer's history and said, well, this would violate due process to deny him his license to practice law. And so that's, there you go. How Schwer and Williamson v. Lee Optical came from the same court is anyone's guess. But that's sort of the history of where we're at now. Like I said, in the 1950s, only about 5% of Americans needed a license. And those were the things that we think of as traditional licenses. Those are doctors and dentists, veterinarians, lawyers, what used to be thought of as the professions as opposed to the occupations. Since the 1950s, again, that number has just exploded. And so now we're licensing all sorts of things. So that's sort of a really thumbnail sketch of this history. There is a book written by Tim Sandifer, used to be with PLF. I think he wrote it when he was at PLF. He's now at Goldwater, called The Right to Earn a Living, which really goes much more in depth in this history, especially the monopoly system under the crown in England and that sort of thing.
Thanks, Paul. One last question, and I realize this is going to be kind of a big bite at the apple for a short answer, but you've been asked to talk about the fact that the federal society usually preaches judicial restraint as opposed to activism. And the concern is about the slippery slope that a more vigorous constitutional interest in economic liberty might have in other areas beyond occupational licensing.
So you are right. This is a massive issue. And frankly, an issue that FedSoc itself has been debating within itself for a number of years. For those of you who've been to the the national conference for a couple of years running, they had debates generally with Randy Barnett on one side and someone else on the other talking about this issue. And so I think it is an issue that's open for debate. My approach to it is this: one, when we talk about judicial activism, what does that really mean? Maybe it had a meaning at one point. I'm not sure it does today. I think today it's a shorthand for decision I don't like. But my take on it is judicial activism is essentially the judicial creation of a right that just doesn't exist. But the right to earn a living does exist. And in fact, the court has recognized that this exists as far back as Corfield v. Coryell, for example, and it's certainly recognized in the state. So it's not a question of does this right really exist? The question when it comes to occupational licensing is really what's the right standard and what's the fit? And courts like to pretend that they are incapable of doing this analysis when it comes to economic rights, even though they're perfectly capable of doing it to lots of other sorts of rights under more searching scrutiny, whether intermediate or strict scrutiny. And so I just don't, you know, this notion that courts are uniquely incapable of doing this means and fit analysis, reasonableness analysis when it comes to economic liberty is just not true. And so really what we're asking for courts to do is to treat economic liberty cases like they do any other case, which is consider the facts, require essentially a reasonable connection between the two, and don't become an advocate for the government. Those are relatively minimalist things to be done. And even people who are opposed to judicial activism sort of writ large have recognized that the court's hands-off approach in this area really has led to massive abuses where you have industry insiders coming in, passing all of these laws that really have nothing to do with public health and safety. And then the courts just sort of wash their hands and say, well, you know, the legislature could have thought something here, even though they clearly didn't think that, even though that thing is clearly unreasonable. And they let them get away with that. That is, we've gone too far in the other direction. And, you know, frankly, has all of this judicial minimalism, frankly, stopped courts from being activists in the other areas in which they have been? I don't think they have. I mean, what we've done is we've sacrificed economic liberty, to try and achieve something else that we haven't achieved, while at the same time not protecting an actually recognized constitutional right. That's not judicial activism. That's just judges doing their jobs.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's 1 p.m. and I want to be respectful of everyone's time. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the questions, but thank you very much for appearing today, Paul. Looks like a beautiful day.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see some familiar names and some at least one familiar face.
Thank you very much. And if anybody wants to reach out to Paul and follow up about any of these issues, just shoot me a message and I'll be happy to connect the two of you. I know he's always interested in reaching out and helping people around the country. With that, thank you all very much and hope to see many of you on March 15th for the student chapter presentation on litigating Arkansas constitutional claims. Have a great day.